Okay, welcome back. Here we are, Masechet Ta'anit. We've moved into the fourth parak. I'm Jeffrey Sachs, coming to you live from a location near Congregation Mishkan Sipora in Efrat via Web Yeshiva to learners all over the world. Station note, next week there's no shiur because of a wedding here in the community. So next week there's no shiur next Tuesday. And there was some confusion. I got some mail. Let me just clarify what I had said last week. We're going to continue, hopefully, to finish Masechet Ta'anit all the way through. You know, we're aiming to do it by the end of the Chagim. And then after the Chagim, the plan is to resume the shiur in person in the shul, but we've worked it out that we'll be able to broadcast it to the Young Israel of Avenue J or wherever Yehudi is. So he can catch it, him and everyone else that needs to can catch it on here on a Web Yeshiva. We are here on Daf Kaf Vav Omud Beis at the bottom, the very bottom. The Gemara had tried to learn something out about Birkat Kohanim, about Kohanim, when they duchen, when they don't duchen. That was the long passage we had last week. And the fear that Kohanim might have imbibed a little something intoxicating, which would preclude them from saying Birkat Kohanim, which is why we, generally speaking, don't duchen after the morning prayers. We don't duchen in the afternoon because generally at lunch people have a little something to drink. This was, by the way, much more common. I don't know how many of you had something. Any of you have anything alcoholic for lunch today? I did not. I don't have one of those jobs where you go out for the three martini lunch. And we don't keep, you know, we don't keep any six packs in the fridge at the office. Although, you know, you see some of these TV shows that are set, you know, back in the day where, you know, executives, you know, would keep a bottle in their desk and everybody would be tossing back all day. One wonders how they got anything. I think, oh, there's David. David's raising his glass. You keep the gin in a May Aiden bottle, nobody notices. I don't know how people got anything done by drinking like that at work. However, in the times of Chazal, and not just in the times of Chazal, even up to the early modern period, people drank a lot more liquor as part of their day because in many, many, many locations, drinking water was not potable. The drinking water was not safe to drink. And what was safe to drink? Fermented beverages. Because the fermentation would, you know, kill all the bacteria that was in the water. So people drank a lot more ale and beer and things like that. It may have had lower alcohol content than some of our liquors, but people were drinking alcoholic beverages much more common. They weren't necessarily getting.
I was going to say, they say that that's actually what led to the Enlightenment, was that. The import of tea and coffee into Europe, suddenly you could actually drink water without being drunk all day long. And suddenly you had something to talk about and you could discuss philosophy and things that you weren't going to do.
And it caffeinated you and kept you awake. As a matter of fact, I think I may have mentioned this before, this book by my friend, Shachar Pinsker, called A Rich Brew, How Cafes Created Modern Jewish Culture. There was an article years ago about the mapping the spread of coffee to Europe with the expansion of the custom of Tikkun Chatzot. You know, like in the pre-modern era, it got dark out. You went to sleep. We mentioned, didn't this come up? Yes, it came up last week, this idea that, you know, going to shul for Mariv was not a thing.
Yeah, I wrote an email about that.
Yeah, but we also mentioned because people weren't going out in the evening and only at the advent of the very early modern era do you begin to see the influx of this idea of nightlife in Europe. And this did have something to do with the spread of coffee, and people staying up later could have then, you know, stayed up for Tikkun Chatzot to say those prayers at midnight. But Shachar's book, A Rich Brew, is about its portraits of different major modern European cities. I think actually not just modern European cities, one is Tel Aviv and one is also New York, and how coffee houses became these centers of intellectual ferment where ideas were tossed around. When we were in Budapest this summer, there are a number of very old coffee houses in many European cities, in Vienna, certainly, in Budapest, in you know, all around. And in one of these places, which still has a kind of feel of like the late 19th century, on the tables, they have these little engraved, indented wells where you could put your ink pot. And the central kind of stand in the coffee house, they gave away paper. In other words, they gave away paper and ink because who was going? This was the coffee house that Herzl was sitting in.
Precursor of today's internet cafe.
It's exactly that. It's the same as Starbucks giving away free internet, because if you're sitting there, you'll buy more coffee. So in those days, they gave away paper and ink to the journalists and the writers and the intelligentsia that were hanging out. Okay, end of the sidetrack. So we were talking about Kohanim could not Duchen if they had been intoxicated. And the Gemara learns this out from the smicha of the parasha of Birkat Kohanim to the Nazir. And just like the Nazir can't drink wine, so too the Kohanim cannot drink before they bless the people. So the Gemara attacks this idea. Matkif lo abud Rebbe Zera. V'omri la Oshaya bar Zavda. Either this Amora or that Amora criticized the idea. So, what's the basis of the critique? E man nozir osir bechartzan, afkoin mevarich osir bechartzan. Wait a second, you're doing a very selective comparison here. You want to say that the source that a Kohen cannot duchen if he's had intoxicating beverages is because we compare it to the Nazir, to the Nazirite. Because the Nazirite can't drink. But the Nazirite can't do all types of things. Not only can't the Nazirite drink wine, he can't even eat grape pits. The grape pits themselves are not intoxicating. We don't say that a Kohen who ate a grape pit can't duchen. The Gemara doesn't mention this, but there are other things that a nazir can't do. A nazir can't become tameh. So a kohen can't duchen in Beit HaMikdash if he's tameh because he can't enter Beit HaMikdash. But our practice of duchening outside of Beit HaMikdash, all of the kohanim that went up, I assure you, all of the kohanim that went up to duchen this morning in our shul are tameh meis. They've somehow become tameh meis, even though they're careful not to go to funerals, right? But manavshach, people are always, you know, even though there's signs out there in the hospital, people go into hospitals, or people have been hospitalized, or people were born in hospitals, right? So that the comparison is not across the board. It's all you're cherry picking or you're grape picking the comparison. So if it's true that a nazir can't eat chartzan, can't eat grape pits, afkoin mevarech asur b'chartzan. Omer Rabbi Yitzchak, Omer Kro. No, there's a posuk. Shartol levarech b'shmo. This is a posuk we read last week, 2 weeks ago, in Parashat Ekev. Hold on, let me get the chumash. The whole posuk is, be'et hahi hivdil Hashem. This is in Perek Yud of Dvarim, in Parashat Ekev. Be'et hahi hivdil Hashem et shevet ha-levi. God designates Shevet Levi for certain avodah, in this particular case, carrying the Aron. La'amod lefnei Hashem l'sharto, to stand in the presence of God and to serve Him, ulevarech b'shmo ad hayom hazeh, and to recite the Birkat Kohanim in His name. To bless the people with His name until this very day for all eternity, right? So the Gemara says, "Ma misharet mutar b'chartzan." Just like somebody who's serving in the mikdash is allowed to eat grape pits, af koin mavarech mutar b'chartzan. So to the coin, meaning since the pasuk compares, we have one pasuk that aligns Nazir and Birkat Kohanim. So from that we learn you can't drink wine. So the Gemara says, but if that were true, we would want to, you know, if A equals B, So everything about B equals A, but that's not true. So the Gemara questions the use of that comparison. So the Gemara says another pasuk. There's another pasuk that says that the Kohanim blessing the people is part of the Avodah. It's part of them, Omed Lefnei Hashem L'Sharto. And just like Omed Lefnei Hashem L'Sharto is allowed to eat grape pits, so too the Mivarech is allowed to eat grape pits. Okay, now switch to the top of Kaf Zayin Omed Aleph.
Question about that. If you're already going to talk about the Avodah, and saying that, you know, the Kohanim who have great pits, you know, that's okay. So then why not just make all of the learning of the drinking wine from the Avodah in terms of like the beginning of Parshat Chevot? Like, wouldn't that make sense to say, you know, like, Parshat Shemini, wherever it says about that you can't have drink wine there. So that seems strange to go into Nazir, which is a whole entirely different.
Right, except for the fact that Nazir is there, you have the Smichat Parashiyot.
Yeah, but you don't need that. In other words, if you're saying if you're saying Berakat Kohanim is like Avodah, then the Kohanim are not to Avodah after drinking wine. You don't need all the comparisons to Nazir.
Excellent. So, David, once again, I congratulate you. I commend you for having learned ahead in the Gemara.
Well, is David assuming that the juxtaposition of Yayin v'Sheichar I'll taste is a reference to Nadav and Avihu drinking? Because that's trash. That's not shot.
No, he's not. I don't think that's what you meant.
Okay, I wasn't sure why.
David, speak for yourself.
I mean, whether that's shot or not, that's a different story. But certainly it mentions in the context of them doing, of them doing the Rav Oda. I'm not sure it's snapshot, but it's not relevant to the particular discussion.
Okay.
So Ima, so the top of Kaf Zayin Amud Aleph. Ima Misharet Balmum Lo. Afkoin mavarech bal mum lo, right? So the Gemara says if when a kohen does the avodah in Beit Hamikdash, can't be a bal mum. You know, there's certain physical blemishes, deformities that if a kohen has, he's invalidated from avodah in the Mikdash. It's one of those things that we have to think about carefully. Certainly doesn't reflect our contemporary attitudes towards people with disabilities, let's say. But in fact, there are people who, if you're Balei Mumin, if you're missing certain body parts, if you have other kinds of physical blemishes, you're not allowed to serve in the Mikdash. So the Gemara says, so just like a Kohen can't do the Avodah if he's a Balmum, so a Kohen who's a Balmum can't do Birkat Kohanim. There are certain halachot about if the Kohen has certain mumim on his face or on his hands, he can't duchin because the people will be distracted by that. Lahalacha, we see now, according to our practice, the way that we do Birkat Kohanim, the Kohanim cover their face and hands with the talit, so that halacha does not apply according to our practice. So the Gemara says this is not correct, that the Kohen who says Birkat Kohanim is also compared to the Nazir, right? A Nazir who's a Balmum is allowed to become a Nazir. So in other words, we don't want to learn it out from it being just another part of the Avodah, and just like you can't do Avodah just like you can't do Avodah when you're a Balmum, you can't Duchen when you're a Balmum. We need that to complement, because if we used only Nazir, we might think that the equation flows in the other direction. Just like a Kohen who's a Balmum, who has a blemish, cannot do Birkat Kohanim, we might think that a person who's a Balmum can't become a Nazir. So we are kind of selectively cherry picking, which is why you might need another source to complement something, because we don't just cut and paste from Nazir. The Nazir comparison is for one specific case only. Umachazit de makasht lekula. So Beseder, why you say, look, we compare, we make a hekesh between Nazir and Birkat Kohanim, and between Birkat Kohanim and the rest of the avodah. So why are you doing it only for the leniency? The leniency to say that, the leniency to say that a kohen who's a bal, a person who's a bal mum can still be a nazir. Akish l'chumra. You could make the hekesh and generate astringency instead, in which you would say that a, in which you would say that 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 a kohen can't even eat the chartzan, can't even eat the grape picks. Right? So the Gemara says no. Asmachta ninhu midrabanan ulakula. The whole thing is, as David anticipated by his question, the whole thing is just an asmachta. An asmachta means this is not the source of the halacha. The asmachta oat are kinds of pegs on which to hang a halacha. They're almost like supporting devices. I mean, that's probably literally what asmachta is. It's just a support, almost like a, not a mnemonic exactly, but it's a way of kind of associating an idea with a hint in the text, but it is not the source. These two ideas of learning something from this and learning something from that, but not taking it in its entirety and cutting and pasting all of the halachot from A to all of the halachot of B, means that we can do it indiscriminately and take what we want from each side. Now the Gemara goes on to something new, continuing with the next Mishnah. But again, because all of the Mishnayot are printed up front, let's go here. Let's just look at the Mishnah to review it before we go back to the Gemara. Eloheina ma'amadot. What are these ma'amadot, these representatives of the B'nai Yisrael? The Mishmarot, the watches, were Kohanim and Levi'im serving in Beit HaMikdash. What were the ma'amadot, the assemblies of the Israelites that would be on duty in some way for that, their share of the service in the Mikdash? Since we tell the Jewish people you have to do the daily sacrifice, Erev Avoker, every morning, every afternoon, and since when a person brings a korban, how could it be that when a person's sacrifice is brought to the altar, v'hu eino omed al gabav? Generally speaking, when you bring a sacrifice, you have to be present. You bring a sacrifice. Every Jew brings a sacrifice every day, twice a day, with the korban tamid. So it's obviously not possible for every single Jew to be present all day, every day in the Beit HaMikdash, 365 a year. 24/7, 365. So what do we do? How do we have the representation of the entirety of the people? It's kinu nevim harishonim, the early prophets. Our Gemara momentarily is going to discuss who these early prophets were. Esrim v'arba mishmarot. They divided the Jewish people into 24 different shifts, different watches. Al kol mishmar mishmar haya ma'amad b'yushalayim shel kohanim shel levi'im shel yisraelim. And at each turn of those shifts, there would be a delegation of Kohanim, Levim, and Israelites. Hegia zman ha-mishmar la'alot, when it was the time for your mishmar to go up to Yerushalayim, Kohanim, Levim, Olim, Yerushalayim, the Kohanim and Levim would go to Jerusalem. The Gemara is going to explain it's not so simple. The Yisrael shebaoto mishmar, and the Israelites, the Mishnah says, mitkansin la'arehen v'korin b'maseh b'reshit. They would gather in their hometown, wherever that was, and they would read the account of Genesis. Were they all there? Were some of them here? Were some of them there? That's the topic of our Gemara. Hold on a second. No. No. Okay, here. So Elohein Ma'amadot Lefish Ne'amat Savet Ne'ezer V'chul. That's the Mishnah. My Ka'amar. My Ka'amar. Hachi Ka'amar. What is the meaning? What's being said here about the Mishmarot? This is what is being taught. Elohein Ma'amadot U'matam Tiknu Ma'amadot. In other words, the Gemara is reading between the lines of the Mishnah. Right? In other words, the Gemara, the Mishnah says, these are the Mishmarot, and the Gemara says, really what the Mishnah is saying is, this is the reason that they invented the whole idea of the Mishmarot to begin with. Why did they do it? In other words, the reason the Mamadot were instituted was to fulfill the need of having a representative korban. V'heich korbano shel adam karev v'hu eino omer al gabav. How could it be that somebody's korban is brought and he's not present? It's kinu neviim arishonim esrim v'arba mishmarot al kol mishmar mishmar hayam amad v'shalayim shel kohanim levim shel yisraelim igi hazman mishmar lalot kohanim levim olim liyushalayim. That's the Bryce's rereading of the Mishnah. Now, Yehudi, you sent me something earlier which I didn't have a chance to fully look at about the meaning of the word korban. What was that?
That was more reference to Korban HaEitzim. So that was just
for you. Oh, not connected to tonight. Not connected to tonight.
Not for today.
Okay. So that's just the Gemara filling in, reading between the lines to flesh out the Mishnah. Tanu Rabbanan. Here's a brayta. Esrim v'arba mishmarot be'eretz Yisrael. V'shtem esrei b'Yericho. There were 20, let's read it as it's written. There were 24 mishmarot, there were 24 of these shifts of Kohanim and Levim in the land of Israel, and 12 of them in Jericho. Jericho, of course, is part of the land of Israel. There were 24. What does this mean? Does it mean that there were 24 all over Eretz Israel and 12 additional in Yericho? Or 24 in Eretz Israel and half of all of them were concentrated in Yericho? What's going on? Nefishan lehu tuva. That's way too many. Why would you have so many? Either half of all of the Mishmarot were centered in Yericho, or a third of all the Mishmarot were centered in Yericho. But in all cases, that's way too many in one place. Ella, so the Gemara says, what does this mean? Shtei mesrei mehen b'Yericho. There were 24 altogether. 12 of them were in Yericho. Higi azman ha-mishmar la'alot. When it was your city's time to go up, chatzi ha-mishmar haya ole me'eretz Yisrael li'ushalayim. V'chatzi ha-mishmar haya ole me'Yericho kidei she'yisapku mayim u'mazom la'acheihem she'b'Yerushalayim. When your Mishmar went up, now how many Kohanim and Levim were in a Mishmar? I don't know. But take the entirety of the Kohuna and the Levia, however many that was. I mean, in times of the Tanakh, we have the counts of the population. In times of Mikdash, presumably those populations had only grown. But you take 1/24th of that, you're talking about thousands of people. You're talking about a lot of people. So what would happen? They wouldn't all go. The Kohanim and Levi'im on duty wouldn't all go to Yerushalayim at once. Why? Well, you've been to Yerushalayim on the Chagim. You ever try going to the old city on Chol Hamoed Sukkos? Right, there are more Jews from the five towns and from Bergen County than there are from all of Gush Etzion put together. I assure you. It's very crowded, right? You're like sardines. You certainly can't find parking anywhere. But
there was dim sufufim.
That's at the time of the avoda and the mikdash, right?
But to be literal, don't you?
But walking through the shuk, that miracle did not happen in the shuk when you had to go get lunch, right? You ever stand on line at one of those places to get a drink in the old city on Chol Hamoed? So there's no miracle there, I'll tell you. So there just simply wasn't a need for all of the Kohanim and Levim to go in. So even the Mishmar was like, you're one shift. You only ever worked half a shift. half the shift, half the mishmar would go to Yerushalayim, and the other half would stay on base, no, not on base, on deck in Yericho. Yericho was like the, what do you call that in military terms? You know, like where you send a group of soldiers ahead, and they're waiting to go into the front, the advance staging area.
It sounds to me like you're talking quartermaster work war. In fact, I'd like to.
Wait, no. So what would they do? So those people, what would they do? What were they doing?
If you're not ready, when you are ready, just let me. I want to say something about it.
Please do.
Okay. So first of all, from Yericho to Yerushalayim is an altitude climb of more than 3,000 feet. So it's a little strange that you put the quartermaster corps in a place where, you know, in order to supply anything, they have to climb 3,000 feet. The other problem with Yericho is the fact that it wasn't even an Iraq Kohanim in the Tanakh. It has the only association that Kohanim ever had with this place when it was first conquered. Subsequently, in Tanakh, it has no association with priests. However, I worked this out, because it really bothered me, and I couldn't find anyone to even address this issue. Like, you know, why Yericho? It has no association with priests at all. So, okay, they come up with one source in Tosefta Menachot, the question is, how did the priests get there and concentrate there? And it appears that this was the effect of the Chashmonaim. Herod and the rest of the crew built palaces there, and the result was that a good selection of the Chashmonai priestly families built themselves houses there and settled there. So what we're reading about here is something that reflects the Herodian and first century period, and it's being, what do you call that, retrojected into the first temple period. Uh-huh. At least the problem is solved. In other words, when the Gemara tells you,
why do you assume that this description is retrograded to Bayit Rishon and not a description of Bayit Sheni?
Well, because eventually it's going to get you to David and Shmuel at the bottom of the daf.
It doesn't necessarily say that they were part of this whole Yericho thing.
Is it possible that that it wasn't necessarily everyone's in Yericho, but was going through Yericho?
In the time of the Chashmonaim,
I'm just wondering if it's possible, I mean, to sort of answer Yudu's question just in general, that, you know, why would focus on Yericho? Even now, if you're going from the Bika, the Arden to Yerushalayim, you pretty much go through Yericho. So maybe they were a place there that they just had, you know, they talked about bringing them food. So maybe they had a station there where, you know, if half the people are going to be coming from Eretz Yisrael, the other half, and half the people are coming through the Bika, and they'll be going through.
Right. Yericho is the next. Yericho is the closest big city, particularly as coming. If you presume that the bulk of the population is north of Jerusalem, right? Yericho is the most logical location for a kind of big encampment like this.
Well, Anatot was still around, even in Nehemiah's time. Anatot was still around,
But that's a rather small. Anatot is a rather small place compared to Yericho.
But, Jeff, Yericho would only...
It's okay to store supplies there. Yeah. Well, I had two questions. Let's make sure we are getting all this.
Okay, but Yehudi, Yehudi, we have to be fair. Ben had a question.
Yeah, no, it just seems to me that Yericho would only be along the way for that segment of the population that live in the very easternmost part of the... of Eretz Yisrael, but those who lived in the western part, or the Galil, et cetera, and so forth, wouldn't be going through Yericho. Those who came from the south, obviously not.
How would you go if you were in the Galil and you were making your way to Yerushalayim? How would you go?
There were paths that took you through.
Not through the Bika? I mean, we go, like, I went to, you know, I mean, we go up now Kfir Shesh now, but before that, if you were going up to the Galil, you went up.
I suppose that they had a Kfir Shesh in those days too. Mm. I mean, take you know, if you were coming from the area of where did Shevet Dan sit?
Shevet Dan was right above Yerushalayim. No, Shevet Dan.
Shevet Dan.
Yeah, Shevet Dan
was once upon a time west of Yerushalayim, yeah. But at this point, well north. Binyamin is north of Yerushalayim. The only reason I mentioned Anatot is because it's an era Kohanim.
Yes.
You know, Yericho's not even that. So the question comes up is, why do they take for granted the half or a third?
Not want it to be an era Kohanim. You would want it to be in an Ir Yisraelim. All these Kohanim would show up, and you needed to have merchants and farmers and other people that could supply the goods.
Yeah, you also wanted to have people who were motivated.
Okay. Anyway,
the other question is a real question, which is, why does Yericho suddenly get associated with, you know, the priestly enterprise at a time when it's clear that at least as far as the end of the Rambam, it's not associated with anything having to do with what's going on in Yerushalayim. So that must have happened subsequently as a result of certain historical developments. In other words, if the Babri tells you something, it does sound strange historically, and it's a good idea to look into how that happened because it's not fitting the period exactly anyway. We're going to see the same thing with the Korban HaEtzim. You know, Korban HaEtzim is barely mentioned in the Tanakh, but it became a big deal in post-biblical times. And remember, this whole chapter is being devoted to developments that took place in post-First Temple times, including these memorial fasts, okay? So I don't think it's that far of a stretch to start trying to find out to what extent developments in the Second Temple period, but I'm talking about the late Second Temple period, are affecting things that this parak is telling us.
Okay, these are all interesting questions to which I am not prepared to give answers at the moment. But it seems that what this is describing is the idea that about half the Kohanim would go up to do the Avodah, and the other half would remain behind in Yericho, and they would switch, meaning no one person ever did more than a half a Mishmor, and the other half would go to Yericho, and the first people would come up and bring the remaining supplies for the week in midweek, and then they would go on. The Gemara goes on. Omer of Yehuda, Omer Shmuel, Kohanim Levim Yisraelim, Ma'akvin et HaKorban, Ma'akvin et HaKorban. The Kohanim Levim and Yisraelim would, the absence of any representation from any one of these three would prevent the fulfillment of the sacrificing of the korban. Without the presence of a representation of each three class, you are unable to offer the korban tamid. B'matnita, the Brisa says, Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar, kohanim levi'im v'klishir ma'akvim et korban. He says that it's the kohanim and the levi'im and the musical instruments whose music would accompany the sacrifices. That's what's necessary. So there's two opinions. One is you need Kohanim, Levim, and Yisraelim. And the other one says you need Kohanim and Levim and the musical instruments which the Levim play. But my kemiflage, what is this machloket about? Mar savar ikar shira bapeh. The first Tana says that the essence of the shira, of the music, of the song that was offered in the Mikdash is the lyrics, is the words, is reciting the song vocally. And the other opinion, that of Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar, says that the main part of the song, the main fulfillment of the obligation to have the music accompanying the Avodah is the instruments. Is playing the instruments. Now we know that this was part of what the Levim did. Right? The Levi'im sang the song, the sweet songs of David Melech Yisrael, Ni'imot Sheke'elo Lo Shama Ozen Yom Shecharva Yireinu, said a certain author in Stockholm in 1966, that the Levi'im would stand on the Duchan and they would say, what songs were they singing?
The Tehillim.
Right? The Tehillim. And there was instrumental accompaniment to the songs. So first of all, let me ask you. So let me ask you. The opinion that says that the main fulfillment of this obligation is the recitation of the lyrics. You know, like as somebody who's not musical, this is always interesting to me when you see that there are songwriters that work together. One provides the lyrics and one provides the mangina, one provides the tune. It's like always interesting to me, like how that works, right? You know, because you think that it's harder to do it that way. Like, how does it work? Like, I write words. I just write prose. I just write poetry, as it were. And then along comes, you know, the malchin and creates a tune. But you can create a tune to my words that are jazzy. You can create a tune to my words that are baroque. You can create two, right? So somehow the two working together, the lyricist and the composer, you know, create the soundtrack to our lives. It, to me, that's always interesting. And which is more?
But the music creator always comes before the words creator. And
I don't know if that's true. I don't think that's true. I think sometimes it works this way and sometimes it works that way.
You know who the librettist was from Mozart's operas?
I do not.
You can look it up on Wikipedia, but my point is his name is totally forgotten. Okay? I'm trying to say is the lyrics are clearly secondary and the music is primary.
Yecholiot, but that's a separate, you're making two completely separate points. Yes, we generally think that the music is the ikar and that the lyrics come afterwards.
And we have musical instruments.
But wait a second, Yehudi, please. Right? But sometimes the words come first and then comes the music, and sometimes the music comes first and then come the words. If you watch, there was that fascinating documentary last year about the Beatles and their creative process, right? And you saw that even some of the Beatles tunes, sometimes it was this way and sometimes it was that. Sometimes John would come in with words and Paul would put the music behind it. And sometimes they just had a niggin and then came up with the words. So the machlokis, what is the essence of what the Levi'im are doing in their song? Is the ikar the recitation of the words, and the musical, the instrumental accompaniment is just window dressing, as it were, or is it the opposite? Now, what's the havamina, the one who says the ikar ashira bapeh? What would you think is the pretty good proof that in fact is the case, that they're the lyrics the main thing?
Yilim talks about Shira a lot. I mean, you know.
No, because what were the words? The words were the Tehillim. In other words, the words were. Hayom Yom.
When you're ready for someone to say the opposite, let me know.
No, in other words, the words were the Tehillim. What's the Ikar? That they're reciting the Tehillim composed by Dovid HaMelech. Okay, Yehudi, please let me finish my sentences before you interrupt. We know what you think. You've said it now three times. Please, please. The recitation of the song is the Tehillim of David HaMelech. Right? Those are the Mizmorim that were recited in the Mikdash. And the fact they have musical accompaniment, which even David recognizes in the Tehillim themselves, it describes the musical, the instrumental accompaniment of but the Mizmor itself, the words of the Mizmorim recited musically during the Avodah seems to be the Ikar. To me, that seems to be the rationale behind the idea of Ikar Shira bapeh, the words that are recited to the musical accompaniment. Now, Yehudi, why do you think that the ikar is the kli?
Okay. Number one, the very fact that so many psalms are basically not just giving a title with an instrument to start with, even words like Yedutun today are thought of as instruments rather than people. Okay, Sheminit, Niginot. It's very clear the psalms were written with the intent to be played to music. Okay, and why do I think that? Because when did they say the Shir Shalavim, are you on Beit HaMikdash, according to Masechet Tamid? Dafka, when they did the Nisa Chayayim. So that means they had a, something had to happen instantly at that moment. Now, it can't just be a cappella. It had to be something that really made an impression on people, and that would be if all the instruments start playing at the same time. By the way, this machloket isn't just here. According to my reference here, this machloket is in two or three other places, in Sukkah, Arachin, as to whether this is ma'akev or not. But if I would sit down and go through Sefer Tehillim, and I have done that, it comes across to me that Shira means singing, Zimra means musical instruments, but as a operationally speaking, this book was intended to be not just recited but musically played, and the big moment of the whole service was at the point that they poured the wine, and then the whole orchestra started going off, and that's why I think that the Zimra is really, really important, and not just the Shira. Remember, the Ikar word in Tehillim is not Shira, it's Mizmor, okay? And that's instrumentation.
So then why doesn't David just write musical notation without words?
Well, we just don't have it anymore. How much
It could have been, in other words, the chiyuv of having music with the karbanot could have been play these instruments, you know, and either there were notes or they could improvise. It was more classical music. It was more jazz. But you could have.
I think Tom may have probably an attempt to give musical notes. And notice that the notes in Sifrei HaMet are completely different than the notes elsewhere. And I believe that's because of the fact that these notes were intended to give people an idea of when to start the music, when to stop the music. For example, in a pasuk in Sifrei HaMet, which is mostly Tehillim, the Olevi Yoreid has more stopping power than Et Nachtah does. So it's clear that the Ta'amim there are of a completely different nature. Even today, you know, in other words, look, this is a nice car. I'll send you an email, Rabbi Sachs. Okay. I'm sure you got
it. Let me just continue now, but I'll ask not to be interrupted at this point so we can finish up one more thought tonight. By the way, we skipped it, but we'll come back to that next time. This is something from the Rishimot Shiurim, the notes that were written up from Rabbi Soloveitchik's Shiurim. In this case, the parallel sugya that appears in Masechet Sukkah and Daf Nun Aleph about Ikar Shira Bapeo Bakli. He observes that the Rambam's opinion is that Ikar Shira Bakli about Ikar Shira Bakli places a Rambam, the Rambam Paskins in Hilchot Klei HaMikdash, Ein Pochatin Miyud Bet Levi'im Omdim Al HaDuchan. They always had minimally 12, our Gemara is going to come to this. They always had minimally 12 Levi'im standing on the platform when the song was sung. B'chol yom lomar shira al ha-korban v'chulei. V'ein omrim shira ela b'peh. Blow kli shi'ikar ha-shira shehi avodata b'peh. V'acherim hayu omdim sham minagnagim b'chli shir. Mehem Levi'im u'mehem Yisraelim miyuchasim. That's the Rambam. The Rambam Paskins, I'm sorry, Yehudi, your opinion is very strong, but the Rambam happens to disagree with you. I wouldn't take it personally.
No.
The Rambam Paskins, the Ikar Shira is the lyrics. Who's reciting the lyrics? The Levi'im are tasked with reciting the lyrics. Accompanying the lyricists were musical instruments. Yes, yes, yes. They never did it a cappella. Correct. They never did it a cappella. But it seems that the main people standing on stage were singing. And around them, lav dafka on the duchan, on the platform, were the musical instruments. It looks, the Rambam's idea looks a little different than the picture from the Machon HaMikdash. By the way, all of these well-known paintings from the Machon HaMikdash, the Temple Institute in Jerusalem, they don't always correspond to the Gemaras. They don't always correspond to, sometimes they're just they're somewhat impressionistic, right? Here, the Levim are standing on the Dukhan and they themselves are playing the instruments. This is not how the Rambam pictures it, that the Rambam would have given us a painting. The Rambam says the Levim on the Dukhan were singing and other people were playing the instruments. Who were playing the instruments? Some Levim and even some Yisraelim of distinguished lineage. Meaning the playing of the instruments wasn't even something that was exclusive to the Levim. Yisraelim were allowed to play the musical instruments in the Beit HaMikdash. They weren't allowed to ascend the Dukhan and to sing. Bahalacha zu posek she'ikar shira b'peh. Bram bahalacha vav, however, just three halachot later in the same chapter, the Rambam says the following. On 12 days a year, a chalil makeh lifnei ha-mizbeach. I asked David today, why is the verb for playing a flute makeh? Like makeh is like bang, you bang on it, like a percussion instrument. So David, right. David, you want to review for us what those different opinions, how this comes to be the word for playing?
I found a couple of different opinions. One was that the opinion of Jastrow was that it started by being just a hit and then it became to be percussion. And from there, it developed into just music in general. The other opinion, according to the Bartanura, is that specifically when referring to a flute, it's talking about tapping on the holes of the flute. So that's also a type of banging, of hitting on it. Yeah. And then there was also a third opinion, which was a little different. Clear, said that there are cases where it's used makeh where there's no instruments at all in Erchen, I think, and they were saying that Yoma, and they were saying you mentioned of makeh, and it's only referring to Shira. And so that also is a question of whether it's originally just meant as a musical, it's an entirely different word, or alternatively, it was talking about even a further development where it's not only talking about musical instrument, but just talking about song, where songs can be an example of makeh.
Okay. So anyway, the Mishnah there is talking about the Chalil, which was used for some other part of musical accompaniment in the Beit HaMikdash. But what's interesting is that the Mishnah says that the Chalil is Doche Shabbat. They would play the Chalil even on Shabbat in the Beit HaMikdash. You know, there were certain things that we don't do outside of Beit HaMikdash. They would do in the Mikdash. For example, in Sukkah, over here in Sukkah, there's the discussion about blowing the shofar in the Mikdash on Shabbat, taking the lulav in the Mikdash on Shabbat. Why? Mipnei shehu chalil shel korban. This chalil, this flute was played with a sacrifice. V'chalil shel korban avodahi. It's part and parcel. It's integral to the service in the temple. In other words, wait a second. If we say that playing this flute is so central to the accomplishment of certain korbanot that it even is allowed to, you're even allowed to violate Shabbat, meaning or to do an act which otherwise would be a violation of Shabbat, doesn't that sound like the musical instrument is pretty essential? That sounds like it's pretty essential. So what do we have? We have a stira in the Rambam. V'im ken shitato omedet benigud l'psak haRambam. The Rambam is contradicting the Rambam. In the first halacha, it seems the ikar is the vocalization. And the musical accompaniment is icing on the cake. Ve'ech mekayem haRambam shtei shitot sotrot. Mitzad echad posek she'ikar shira b'peh. Mitzad sheni she'chalil doche et haShabbat. How can the Rambam in one place seem to say the ikar shira b'peh and another place to say the musical instrument is so central and essential that it's even allowed to override the Shabbat? That's a really good question. However, I apologize. I'm going to leave you now with that question because we're back to the school year. and I have to leave to take my son back to yeshiva now. Otherwise, we're not going to make it on time. But we'll pick up with this question next time. If you're interested, I can send around this piece from Rabbi Soloveitchik for people who want to look it over on your own in the next 2 weeks. Because again, unfortunately, next week we do not, we will not have a shiur. We will meet in 2 weeks from now. So thank you and good night.
Shabbat shalom, Rav Zacks.